Welcome to Straight Talk with Wine Spectator, a podcast from the world's most widely read wine magazine. Here on Straight Talk, we're introducing you to some of the most intriguing and accomplished stars of the wine and service industries. And we'll also catch you up on the wine world's biggest stories, trends, and upcoming events.
I started Mazzucana, you know, one of the myriad of reasons was because my mother couldn't afford Larkmead. Like when my mother buys one bottle of red wine a week, it was under $15 if she spent that much. So Mazzucana wasn't under $15, but it was a lot closer to $15 than Larkmead was. So I wanted to do something that would bring more people great wine.
I'm James Molesworth, Senior Editor and Special Projects Director for Wine Spectator. And today our guest is winemaker Dan Petrosky, the founder of the popular Mazzucana brand. Dan joined us back in season one of Straight Talk as he discussed the state of wine in America with our senior editor for news, Mitch Frank. I couldn't wait to invite him back for a full interview, as he's always got a lot to say. He's had some big changes at Mazzucana recently. I'm going to talk to him about how he got into wine, how he learned to make wine, and what he has his sights set on for his next own project at Mazzucana. All that in just a bit. We'll also be answering your questions, too. To help us out with that, we've got our mysterious advice columnist, Dr. Vinny, stopping by a little later. But first, let's check in with podcast director Rob Taylor.
Hello, James. I really enjoyed sitting in on your interview with Dan. He's a lot of fun.
Thanks, Rob. And you're a lot of fun, too. What have you been up to lately?
Well, over in the video department, we've been prepping a huge exclusive interview from Wine Spectator editor and publisher Marvin R. Shanken that just came out. He sat down with Italian wine icon Angelo Gaia for a really incredible interview, both from a historical perspective, but also just as two industry titans with big personalities who've been friends for decades. And of course, I brought a clip.
I seem to recall you actually moved to San Francisco. And if my memory serves me right, I said, well, why are you moving to San Francisco? And you said, because I want to learn to speak English.
I never learned English, but I went there in San Francisco in 85.
And while you were there, you met and became friends with a guy that probably changed your life.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can watch the full hour-plus interview and lots of shorter highlight clips at winespectator.com. And it's also the cover story for Wine Spectator's April 30th issue on newsstands now.
That Gaia interview gives me a great segue opportunity, Rob. Thank you for that. The April 30th issue also includes my colleague, senior editor Bruce Sanderson's Piedmont Tasting Report, covering recent vintages of Barolo, Barbaresco, and more. And it features my annual Bordeaux tasting report on the 2021 vintage, which even the Bordelais could not spin into a vintage of the decade status, Rob.
I hear the news is not good. Give us a preview.
Well, 2021 is not a strong year by any stretch of the imagination. It's the first vintage since 2013 where I did not rate a single wine at 95 points or higher.
Wow.
There are some bright spots, but you really have to dig. But hey, if you like muscle cars and gritty action movies from the 70s, you might dig it. And hopefully that teaser will get you over to read the full report in the April 30th issue.
Thank you, James. And I have one last programming note. Wine Spectator's Grand Tour Super Tasting of more than 200 plus wines rated 90 points or higher is coming to my hometown of New Orleans on April 26th, followed by stops in Las Vegas and Denver in May. For more details and to buy tickets, visit grandtour.winespectator.com.
Thanks, Rob. And now for the main event. Let's go to my interview with Mazzucana founder and winemaker Dan Petrosky. Our guest for this episode is a Brooklyn native who, after attending Columbia University, began his professional career as a journalist for Time magazine. While there, he earned an MBA, and then when a chance to move to the Wall Street Journal came up, he pivoted completely away from journalism, put away his reporter's notebook, and went off to Sicily to intern at a winery. And the rest is history. Dan Petrosky, welcome to Straight Talk.
Thank you, James. Happy to be here.
This is your second time on the show, first time as our lead interview. And as a guy from Brooklyn, I'm not going to hold that against you since I'm from Queens, but I think we can get along, right?
Well, my early days, Andy Smith, who was my mentor at Dumont and Larkmead, he said I was Brooklyn's best winemaker. Fortunately, I told him there was a lot of moonshine and swill being made in the basement and the catacombs of churches throughout the city. So
you moved up.
Moved up in the world.
Well, we'll get to the rest is history part in a bit. I do want to talk about some of your early days, which is one of the favorite questions we ask people here. What was your first wine epiphany?
That was a Midtown experience at La Bernardin. So it was a couple blocks from the Time Inc., Time Life building. I was dating a girl at the time whose best friend was marrying a Hollywood producer. He was a very quiet guy. And the only thing that really got him excited and got him energized and got him talking a lot at dinner was wine. So we were at La Bernardin, and he pulls out the list. This was pre-Aldo Somm days. I tell Aldo the story mm-hmm. all the time. He pulls out the list, and he finds Sean Thackeray's Pleiades. And wine comes to the table. So this is 1999. Mm-hmm. And it was, just saw his eyes light up, saw him talking about the seven grapes of, you know, of the wine, this red wine from California, and started talking about Sean's history as a former art dealer, talking about, you know, the constellation Pleiades and the seven sisters, and how it all kind of wove into the story about the wine. And we all know that that wine, even today, is not a very expensive bottle of wine, but the story was just, it put me enwrapped. And that day on, I literally the next day in Midtown went to Morel's wine shop, bought a copy of the Wine Spectator, and I figured out, hey, I need to, in order to have a better conversation with this guy who's going to be my best friend's girlfriend's husband, I need to like bone up on wine.
Yeah. Well, that's a cool story. So this happens while you're working at Time Magazine.
This is correct.
Prior to that, you really weren't into wine.
No, I actually, throughout my 20s, the smell of white wine made me nauseous. It was my tequila moment in college. So I played football in college at Columbia, and everyone from a collegiate perspective knows Columbia had one of the worst losing streaks mm-hmm. in college football history. So we were all determined to create a winning program, and we lost our first game. And on a Friday night, we drank too much free white wine with our chicken and broccoli at the Columbia Cottage that was two blocks away, and it really was my tequila moment. I only drank a few times after that in college and couldn't drink wine for about 10 years. Couldn't stand the smell of it.
Interesting. So after you have this wine epiphany while you're at Time Magazine, did you ever think about writing about wine?
No, it's funny you ask. I never did, but when I moved and took my sabbatical to Sicily, I created a blog called The Spaghetti Westerner. And I just kind of recorded, you know, for my mom, basically, and a couple of friends that I was living vicariously through, just my adventures in Sicily for a year. It wasn't anything special. It wasn't anything crazy. It was just a kind of a diary for myself and for people to read across the ocean.
So you come home and you're in New York for a bit. You're figuring out your next move. I think this is about 2006 now. And you get an offer to work a harvest at Larkmead Cellars in Napa Valley, pretty prominent Cabernet producer. And that's where you meet your
Andy
mentor,
Smith.
Andy Smith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell us about that. What, I mean, was this just total happenstance that you got the call, or were you looking for work out west? How did it work out?
So 2006, you know, come June, July, people are starting to realize it's a much bigger crop than anyone anticipated. So Andy had one intern. He's like, I'm looking for another intern. It was late summer. And so they put me in touch with Andy. So I actually ended up, you know, in working in the vineyard in Dumont, like basically August 1, you know, boots on the ground for 4 or 5 days a week because it was a late season, large crop. And then once we were able to get things into the cellar, he also asked me, big crop on the Larkmead side, are you willing to split time, do both things? And I said, sure. If I can get paid for 7 days a week, I'd really like that. So, and they didn't want me to be working 7 days a week because that's double time and overtime in California. So they were able to kind of split me up a little bit. And towards the end of the harvest, I remember it clear as day. It was we were our last pick at Dumont, and it was actually Halloween. And we were all excited about, you know, our end of harvest dinner coming up the next week. And he pulled me into this little office in the crush facility and said, I want to offer you a job. And I was like, to do what? And he's like, to be the cellar master at Larkmead. I'm like, to do what? I was like, I was so shocked. I had no idea. Like what? I didn't know anything.
Did you not feel like you had your sea legs at that point?
No, not at all. I was scared shitless, honestly. Mm-hmm. And he's like, no, look, you're an adult. You're older than most interns. You're 33. You are mature. I'm confident giving you the keys to lock up the joint at night. You're curious. You work hard. My nickname during harvest was the machine. And he was like, well, everything else will fall into place. And it's a small team at Larkmead, and we need people who are doing jack of all trades. You can do everything. So from working hospitality in the tasting room, you know, being a storyteller, being in sales, you can do spreadsheets. You have the business school background as well. You can make the wine. I'm confident we can, you know, get you there. And I was like, okay. And that was it.
When they make the movie of Dan Petrosky, I think we've got the title, the 33-year-old intern. When do you feel like you began to understand the history of Napa Cabernet and why it is what it is today and why some of these names are so exalted?
That was in 2007 when the proprietor and his wife, you know, he had resigned from his, from his job in San Francisco as a lawyer and decided he wanted to come up to Napa Valley, live on the estate and kind of take over the presidency, the kind of the general manager operating role. And first thing he said to me, goes, oh, you worked at Time Magazine. I want to be the chronologer. I want you to be the historian of Larkmead. So I basically took the opportunity for about 6 months to research the history of Larkmead, which was basically the history of Napa Valley. If you're going, you know, from pre-prohibition era all the way through the founding of the Napa Valley Vintners, all the way through kind of an era of selling grapes and the expansion of Napa Valley in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, and then going even deeper to the relationship that the Larkmead estate had with Dr. Harold Omo, who planted the first, you know, experimental Cabernet vineyard at Larkmead in the late 1930s, early 1940s, was there for 15 years. When UC Davis opened up their viticultural station in Oakville, they took the clones of Cabernet from the Larkmead site to UC Davis's parcel in Oakville, which became the Oakville clones, which built the Napa Valley in the 70s. And like, I was like, holy shit, this all happened here. Like, I would leave the property and walk across the street and see the dirt and where Olmo had planted his vineyard. And he was the funnest part of being the historian and trying to figure out Dr. Harold Omo was even talking to his daughter, because she said he and all of his colleagues said he was very cryptic. He was very concerned about his intellectual property. And so he wrote a lot of things in code. And the maps he drew of the estate of Larkmead were almost like puzzles. You had to say, that doesn't really look like that was there at the time. And so you had to kind of piece things together to understand what it was. But then we found some really great articles in his files. And he has 100 file boxes in the library of UC Davis. And before Cam Baker passed away, him and his wife decided to fund the digitization of those files. But unfortunately, it was the pandemic. So I'm hoping that that project gets repicked up, because I'm pretty sure there's a lot of great history to understand some of the questions we're asking today about making wine in Napa Valley or making wine anywhere in the world, maybe even climate change questions, because he was such a great, great mind in our industry that gets us, doesn't get a lot of people talking about him so much.
So you're at Larkmead and you actually start developing your own brand there, Massacan. And I should say this was above board. You weren't like sneaking around doing this on the side, but it's a white wine brand. So a bit of whiplash there. You know, what pushed you to start Massacan? Were you burned out on Cabernet, or was it your tug of Sicilian roots, or what was it?
It was a number of things. One of them being that when I was living in Italy for a year, living on an island in the Mediterranean, we didn't drink a lot of red wine. You know, I always tell the story that Mount Etna red wines were not a very prominent player at the time I was there in 2005 and 2006. That didn't really come to a couple years later. And so I came back. I came back to the States and living in California, realizing that this is a very Mediterranean-style climate. It's, you know, hot days, warm nights. They get kind of breezy after 8 p.m. and cold, and you put a sweater on. No different than living in the southern Europe and in the Mediterranean. But we didn't drink the way you lived in southern Europe and in the Mediterranean. We drank the wines from our grapes, from our land. And our land, because of the sunshine, produced really rich, dominant, bold flavored wines, whether it be Cabernet or Pinot Noir, Sauvignon Blanc or Chardonnay. So I was kind of yearning for, you know, what I'm going to drink at 8 o'clock when I'm sitting outside in my porch having a dinner party with my friends. And we often turn to buying European white wines and drinking those. So the fact that there wasn't as many of those styles or brands in California at the time was kind of intriguing to me. I found it as an opportunity to kind of drink what Mother Nature's, you know, weather, temperature, terroir above ground was giving us, and having a niche in that marketplace.
Well, stepping out on your own is a risk. Stepping out on your own with a white wine brand in Napa is a risk. It paid off for you, because shortly after you went out on your own, a little company called Gallo comes along and buys your brand. And they did it in the same week that they bought Rombauer, which is a massive brand with six-figure case productions and known for oaky Chardonnay. And they buy your brand, which was probably less than 10,000 cases at that point, and is known for aromatic white. So again, that whiplash thing. I got to ask you, did you get any blowback?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I you know, you can't do anything or say anything anywhere on social media these days without people dunking on you in some capacity. And people who I don't even know will create judgment as to why I did things. And like, I see that on there. And, you know, for me, it's always just been kill them with kindness, you know, say thank you for your response to this question that wasn't asked to you and speaking on my behalf. But, you know, the reality of it is this is the blocking and tackling of what I'm trying to do and the partnership that I needed to really achieve the goals that I want to achieve. And you know, I'm very, very honest about this. I'm like, there's a Pinot Grigio brand from Italy that advertises in your magazine. And I look at that son of a bitch and I'm like, I'm coming for you. And I just, I want Masakan advertising, full page, full bleed ads in the Wine Spectator. So I'm competitive. That's my football playing days. And, but it's all in good fun because I do love that, you know, this industry can kind of sit down and break bread with each other and drink a glass of wine. And anyone who dunked on me, I would say, next time you're in Napa, let's just crack a bottle and talk about it. I started Masakan, you know, one of the myriad of reasons was because my mother couldn't afford lark meat. Like when my mother buys one bottle of red wine a week, it's usually it was under $15 if she spent that much. So Masakan wasn't under $15, but it was a lot closer to $15 than lark meat was. So I wanted to do something that would bring more people great wine. And this was the easiest way to do it. And I hate when I hear my peers talk about people are not drinking wine today. It's false. The per capita consumption of wine has increased in the last 10 years. At the same time, the per capita consumption has increased. We've gotten 20 more million drinking adults in America. So we have a huge absolute volume increase of consumption of alcoholic beverages in this country. So people are drinking. It's just they're choosing to drink different things today. And I think that that's something that we as a community of wine producers and suppliers and journalists, we have to learn how to talk to people a little bit differently than we did and not kind of rest on our laurels. And I think white wine is it's the future.
Are you still the eternal optimist that I think you are?
No, I'm a hater. I'm from New York.
That's the Brooklyn side.
No, I'm excited about the future of California. I'm excited about Napa Valley. I think there's just a Darwinian in me believes that there has to be a thinning of the herd. I think that that's not a pretty thing. I don't want to see any of my friends be hurt in any way, shape, or form. I want to be there to support them. But the reality of it is like there are brands that that won't exist in 5 or 10 years. And a lot of it is just because we've pushed so fast and so hard. I used to always say this to the owner and general manager of Lark Meat, and I almost got fired. I was like, we got too successful too quickly. We didn't know what it was to not sell through the wines. We didn't know how hard it was. And I think that was something that if you're a history student or a student of history, if you're a student of the industry, student of business, it's really difficult to kind of hear that and like be like, I don't understand what you're talking about. And like, and then it was funny you mentioned this earlier in the conversation. You said in a short time, my short time of Masakan was 15 years. I love that you, like me, think that a short time in wine industry is 15 years. And in a short time, that was a little quicker than I thought I would. I've gotten to the point I did with the Gallo family, but you know, it took 5 or 7 years for some wine brands in Napa Valley. See, some of the brands that you cover in the magazine took them less than 5 or 7 years to be wildly successful and above and beyond their means. And places like Premier Napa Valley were the places that helped them get there. The Memento Moris of the world is a big, you know, brand of Premier Napa Valley. And I think that was, you know, what kind of really solidified them as one of the unique cultish brands of Napa. Still hard to get. I mean, I know all the people there and I can't get a bottle of their wine. I'm optimistic that we'll get through this. I'm not worried about the current economy. I started Masakan in the Great Recession in 2009. And a lot of brands started, and the whole new California movement started in 2009, 2010. And there's a lot of my friends that have been wildly successful in doing what they love to do. And I think we need that next generation of innovation. I don't see it anywhere right now because, honestly, it's just the business is too expensive.
Well, Dan Petrosky, I will take that as a cautiously, eternally optimistic look at the wine industry. And it is a long game because you are proof of that. You went from a guy who couldn't stand the smell of white wine to now running one of the most interesting white wine brands out there that has a new owner, and you get to be the caretaker with a chance to really grow it and turn it into something special. So, Dan, again, congratulations on your accomplishments, and good luck to you going forward, and thanks for joining us today at Straight Talk.
Thanks for having me, James.
Great interview, James, and Dan never disappoints.
No, he doesn't. You know, and lots of winemakers keep their heads down and just make the wine, and I applaud that monastic approach. Dan's a little different. He's always scanning the horizon for ideas and trends and new ideas, and he's on top of like the making of wine and what could be done differently. I applaud his success. He's always a great interview. As for those air quote offbeat white varietals he's working with, if you're not familiar with them, perhaps it's time for a checkup with Dr. Vinny.
Cheers to that.
Paging Dr. Vinny. Paging Dr. Vinny. Code Rouge in the podcast studio.
It's time once more to return to the offices of Dr. Vinny, Wine Spectator's longtime trusted advisor for all things etiquette and education. Hello, Dr. Vinny.
Hey, Rob.
As you know, we just had Masakan's Dan Petrosky on the program, and the category he's most known for is basically other whites of California. Other than what, exactly?
Rob, good question. And, Rob, if you don't mind, I'm going to half answer this as Dr. Vinny and half answer this as my alternate personality, Marianne Warbeck, who's the lead taster for California's other white wines. So if you can picture me, I'm just wearing the head of the Dr. Vinny costume.
Senior editor Marianne Warbeck, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Rob. So good to be here. It's been a while. So when you're looking at the landscape of California white wines, the two major categories are Chardonnay and Sauvignon Blanc.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, we kind of lump all the other varieties into this alternative or other white or even aromatic white category.
Okay, so if we're not talking about Chardonnay and Sauvignon Blanc, which grapes are we talking about?
Yeah, so it's a big, wide landscape out there. So everything from Chenin Blanc to Spanish varieties like Albarino. It could include Riesling, Gewurztraminer, and there are a ton of Italian white wine varieties, including Vermentino, Fiano, and Pinot Grigio.
And this is a category that is trending upward, is that right?
Oh, absolutely. And I would say a lot of it is in the wake of Sauvignon Blanc. I mean, it's mass popularity. And I also review Sauvignon Blancs from New Zealand. So I put a lot of Sauvignon Blanc in my mouth every year. And I will say that Sauvignon Blancs and their zingy acidity, their lighter body, their aromatics are fresh and lovely are such a good pairing with food. And I think everyone was a little surprised at how much Sauvignon Blanc was embraced by the wine drinking public, that this category kind of rides the coattails of it a little bit.
Now, one of those grapes you mentioned was Pinot Grigio.
Yes.
And one of our most asked questions is, what's the difference between Pinot Grigio and Pinot Gris?
There is no difference, Rob.
So they're interchangeable?
Yeah, in a way. It's one of those scenarios where one grape goes by multiple names.
Okay.
So in this case, Pinot Grigio refers to the Italian name, and Pinot Gris refers to the French Alsatian name.
Now, when someone is making a wine from this grape here in the States, they can choose to call it Pinot Grigio or Pinot Gris. Does that choice tell us anything about the style of the wine?
Maybe. So the Pinot Grigios tend to be a little lighter, a little spicier, I guess, than Pinot Gris, which tends to be a little rounder, a little smoother, a little richer. So when a winemaker decides to call it one or the other, that might be an indication for style, but there's no regulation for this. This is simply, you know, just their choice or what they're inspired by.
Now, Dan Petrosky, he calls it Pinot Grigio. He's got big ambitions for that grape. Is that right?
Oh, my gosh, absolutely. And I think he told me when I was researching my last report that he really hopes to have a bottle of his Pinot Grigio on every table in America. And if anyone can do it, I'm pretty sure he can.
Marianne, thank you so much for sharing all of your knowledge on the other whites of California. It was great chatting with you today.
Oh, always a pleasure, Robin. Come back for your checkup with either me or Dr. Vinny anytime.
I will soon. In fact, you're the only checkup I look forward to. And I want to remind all the Dr. Vinny heads out there that you can find all of her advice columns for free at winespectator.com.
And that's it for this episode of Wine Spectator's Straight Talk podcast. We'll have another exciting interview next month, and senior editor for News Mitch Frank will also be returning.
And don't forget to say hi to Mitch at the Grand Tour in New Orleans next month.
In the meantime, if you're liking what you're hearing here, don't forget to tell your buddies about it and tap that rating for us on whatever podcast platform you're listening to. And if you have topics you'd like to know more about or interview subjects you'd like to hear from, drop us your comments at straighttalk@winespectator.com. And don't forget to follow Wine Spectator on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, Threads, and X. Until next episode, this is James Molesworth reminding you to always share when you drink the good stuff.